From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, Milwaukee's Hunger Task Force explains how federal funding cuts are already affecting food assistance for people in Wisconsin. Then we'll talk to a student at UWM's branch campus in Waukesha, who's preparing for the school's closure.
I know that the campus closing is kind of a loss for a lot of people.
We'll speak with the superintendent of Milwaukee County's Community Reintegration Center about her approach to rehabilitation.
The fact of the matter, especially those individuals at the CRC, they're going to return to the community. So it's a matter of how do you want individuals to return to your community? I would assume better and not creating more victims.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Trump administration is making major cuts to federal programs. The cuts have been swift and far-reaching, including a cut of more than $1 billion to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA. The USDA cuts will mean a drastic reduction in funding for food banks and local farmers, including here in Wisconsin. The Hunger Task Force helps supply food banks throughout the state of Wisconsin. I went to its facility in West Milwaukee to meet up with Hunger Task Force CEO Matt King and learn more about how these federal cuts are affecting their ability to care for the people of Wisconsin.
So this is our volunteer center. We host over 10,000 volunteers on an annual basis who all come to be a part of the mission. And in particular, in this space, what they do is pack what's called a stock box. And so every month we serve 10,000 low-income seniors with a program called Stock Box. And that activity is all driven by community volunteers.
So what do they get in the stock box?
Yeah, so the stock box is a supply of healthy foods, primarily non-perishable foods. We often accompany it with produce from our farm during the growing season or other meats and dairy that we're able to procure. But stock box is about 10 days supply of food for a senior.
All right. So I'm curious, are you still working with people right now at the USDA? There's still enough people to be working? Because sometimes you open up a news report and it's like, no one's here now.
Yeah. Yeah. The USDA is still staffed and still in communication with us and still running a variety of really important programs.
That's good. Mm. How dependent are you on the USDA versus the locals?
So from a food perspective, looking at the inventory that's in the food bank, right now, a little over 50% of the food comes from USDA commodity programs. Our organization is not heavily dependent upon federal funding to operate. So from a cash revenue perspective, we don't rely heavily on federal funds. But from a food inventory and food revenue perspective, that is the main base of the inventory of the food bank. Mm. Through the Farm Bill, every 5 years, Congress allocates a certain amount of money to the Emergency Food Assistance Program. And the Emergency Food Assistance Program allocates money to the states based on a formula of poverty and unemployment to give each state their pro rata share of those funds through food commodities.
Have you seen that shifting at all? Have you seen perspectives on how we dole out emergency food assistance shifting? Because I know it's really hard to read, because I feel like as a person who's not really involved with the government, reports on it, you just see kind of a lot of different signaling, mm-hmm. and it's hard to know.
Yeah. What we have seen is what seems to be a strategy to increase barriers to access. So further restricting who can have access to resources. There's even talk about removing something called categorical eligibility, which essentially if a family qualifies for a particular program based on their income, then the agency has the ability to enroll them in other programs without them having to reapply and go through some of the cumbersome paperwork. So by eliminating the ability to do that and the administrative ease of doing that, what will happen is there will be a certain percentage of attrition where families will fall off of a program because they didn't know that they had to reapply, or they didn't find out in time. And so there definitely seems to be a strategy to increase barriers.
So it seems like right now it's more red tape, but there is at least like the desire to continue funding these programs. Does that seem accurate?
Well, while many of these programs will continue and are written into the law, they are looking at significant cuts in the budget reconciliation that's happening right now. And so whether that's the SNAP program, or in Wisconsin it's known as Food Share, or whether it is some of these commodity programs that supply the food bank, there is a high likelihood, given the current state of budget reconciliation, that there will be significant cuts to those programs. Mm.
What does that mean for an organization like Hunger Task Force?
Yeah, from our perspective, we've always been a community-driven organization supported by the local community here in Milwaukee. And so we're not overly reliant upon federal funding for that reason. But what it will do is increase the need, because while our organization will be healthy and strong, the number of individuals who are, you know, forced to seek help as a result will increase. And so it'll put a strain on resources, and you know, we're confident that we'll be able to serve the need as we always have, but it's unnecessary.
As you look around this space, so we talked a bit about these boxes for seniors. What all are we looking at?
Yeah, so as we come out of the Volunteer Action Center here and come into the warehouse, you'll see food that supplies food pantries across our city, across the region, and even throughout the state.
It is, just to describe this, it is just pallets and pallets and pallets.
Yeah, so there's a variety of foods here, whether it's fruits, vegetables, grains, proteins. You'll see all the different food groups as we walk through here. And you'll also see 10,000 square feet of cold storage. And so we also have perishable goods, including meats, dairy, cheese.
And this is a giant...
this is a giant freezer.
Yeah. Oh, wow, yeah. Woo!
Yeah, so this is actually an example of one of the products that was canceled. So you see chicken breasts, chicken leg, turkey, there's ground beef.
Yeah.
You can see there's orders both locally here in Milwaukee, but then orders for Sheboygan that are here.
Yeah, sometimes we think about these big organizations in big cities as being, you know, just for, thank you so much, as being just for, you know, our communities. but I think a lot of people underestimate how much the rest of the state really interacts with Milwaukee.
Yeah, Hunger Task Force operates a statewide coalition called the Hunger Relief Federation. There's over 150 organizations throughout the state that are a part of the Hunger Relief Federation.
Yeah. I mean, you have the space here and all of these people who can volunteer. There's a real benefit to population density, I would imagine, in trying to run an organization like this.
Well, I'm particularly proud of this community. It's a community that cares. It's a community that gives, and it's a community that doesn't accept hunger. And so that's why Hunger Task Force has been able to execute the mission successfully for the last 50 years, is that we're a part of this community and we're really driven by the support of the community.
That's great.
That was Matt King, CEO of the Hunger Task Force. I met up with him at their facility in West Milwaukee. UW-Milwaukee's branch campus in Waukesha is set to close this summer. Some students are preparing by transferring to the main UWM campus in Milwaukee, where their tuition rate will be honored. UWM is also creating a university center at Waukesha County Technical College, so students can transfer there to continue their degrees. The UW System's branch campuses offer a lower-cost option for students to earn associate's degrees. But the system has shuttered many of the two-year schools in recent years due to declining enrollment. The Waukesha campus's enrollment has shrunk by more than 60% since 2020. WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel caught up with one UWM Waukesha student who transferred to the school this year. Vanessa Harris grew up in Heartland and chose to come to Waukesha from Edgewood College in Madison. She begins by explaining why.
I started at Edgewood College in Madison. I left because it was a little expensive, and the tuition here is significantly cheaper. And I wanted to finish out my associate's degree, and this was just a good choice because of the proximity to where I'm living, as well as the cost.
You mentioned to me, you know, before I started recording that you grew up in Hartford, and so now you're in Waukesha. Do you plan to stay in Waukesha after campus closes?
I do not, actually. I'm going to be moving to Milwaukee after the campus closes. When I transfer there, I'm going to be living on campus.
So you're transferring to UW-Milwaukee, living downtown?
Yep.
Okay. What was the process like for transferring from UW-Milwaukee's campus at Waukesha to the downtown campus? When did you start that process? Did you need to be accepted? How did that work?
Actually, there wasn't a whole lot that I had to do. My advisor helped me through a lot of it, and for the most part, I just sign up for the classes, and they're just going to bump me over. The most difficult part of it is just applying for housing, but it's a pretty simple process.
Are you pursuing a bachelor's degree when you move to Milwaukee, or are you working on your associates?
So I'm going to finish out my associates first, just because I only have two classes left before I finish that, and then I'm going to be working on my bachelor's degree.
Excellent. That's so exciting. What do you want to do with a sociology degree? Where do you hope to be when you have a degree in sociology?
My plan, hopefully, is to do something in research. I really want to focus on family dynamics. I find those really interesting, as well as cultural dynamics, specifically in like racial categories. That is my main interest, but again, we'll see how that changes.
Everything can change over time, but you have a solid idea of what you're interested in, right? And that's what matters right now. How do you view the importance of the campus in this community, and what does the closing mean to you?
I think that it's really important. I mean, there are a lot of people who go here and plan on being here from beginning to end. I mean, they've got quite a few programs here. And as well, as it's also important as a stepping stone. Some people start here and even before campus is closing, plan to transfer somewhere else. And I know that the campus closing is kind of a loss for a lot of people, quite a few people.
When you are talking to friends here, people in classes, does it seem like most people are transferring to the downtown campus? Does it seem like anyone you know is leaving school and not going to finish their degree? I mean, what's the temperature from your point of view? I'm not asking you to tell me how everyone at UW-Waukesha is moving onward.
So most people I know are transferring to the campus in Milwaukee. Quite a few people, even people who aren't my friends. I overhear people talking about it. And a lot of people are also transferring to other schools within the UW system, but primarily the Milwaukee campus. I will say that one thing for student workers here, people like myself, there is a little bit of uncertainty in the job area. I mean, this school employs quite a few students. So some of us are a little worried about the job aspect of this, not just the school aspect.
What is your job right now on campus?
So I work in the student development office. I'm an office assistant. I copy papers and print stuff.
A very important job in any office. So what are your costs going to be like when you move downtown? I mean, how are you navigating that? And you mentioned that you were working on living on campus. How does the cost compare?
So it's going to be more expensive living on campus just because dorms are expensive, very expensive. And my costs, just like living costs, are also going to be a lot higher since I'm not going to be living with my grandmother anymore. But hopefully, fingers crossed, me working here, I can get a job on campus there as well as a part-time job off campus. So we'll see how that works out.
So you're going to be going from working one part-time job to two part-time jobs to afford the change in living costs?
That is the plan, yeah, at the moment that is the plan.
And going to school full-time?
Yep.
I see. Well, what you're touching on is kind of a big piece of this, right? Is that this campus for a very long time has been a lower cost option where a lot of students can live at home, where they don't have any rent costs. I mean, the on-campus fees are generally lower than a campus that needs to support on-campus housing, things like that. And so it sounds like your experience is kind of shaped by how much more expensive things are going to get when you're on campus. How do you feel about living in a dorm when you're 21? I mean, you will conceivably be living with students who are a couple of years younger than you.
So that is something that I did think about. I try not to think about it in a negative way. I try not to be pessimistic about it. I mean, we're all there to learn. We're all there for the same thing. And, you know, I'm sure that there will be other people also in similar situations, maybe even people from here who might be doing the same thing or something similar. But, you know, I think that it'll be fine. I think it'll go all right.
Yeah, I gotcha. Is there a reason that you're choosing to live on campus as opposed to off?
Primarily because I can't afford an apartment.
That'll do it.
Yeah, it's the rent is expensive, especially near campus. And commuting to campus from Waukesha every day is also very expensive. And my car isn't exactly the best. So it's kind of practical. It's a bit more practical.
What do you drive, just for the record?
I drive a Toyota Corolla, 2003, so same age as me.
Oh my gosh, that's a good point. Yeah, so maybe we're not going to push her. We're not going to push the 2003 Toyota Corolla on icy roads.
No, she's not meant for that.
Will you bring your car to campus?
Right now, I don't believe I will. When I was living on campus in Madison, I got around with the buses pretty well. I don't mind public transport. In fact, I think it's important. And also, parking passes are expensive.
Thanks That was UWM Waukesha student Vanessa Harris, speaking with WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning sociologist Matthew Desmond, who has studied eviction and poverty in cities, including Milwaukee. But first, the leader of Milwaukee County's Community Reintegration Center talks about incarceration and rehabilitation. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, formerly known as the House of Correction, is the state's largest county correctional institution. Located in Franklin, people incarcerated at the facility serve misdemeanor sentences and return to our communities after less than a year. In recent years, the center has focused more on offering vocational and health programming to people incarcerated there, getting families involved, and inviting audits of the facility from third-party observers. Chantel Jewell is the superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. She joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to discuss the center's approach to rehabilitation.
I want to start with some core facts about the Community Reintegration Center in Franklin, formerly known as the House of Corrections. First, how many people are in your care, and what is the average length of stay?
So today we have approximately 1,215 individuals in our care at the CRC, and we call it the CRC for short. And the average length of stay for individuals that are sentenced to the CRC is 100 days.
Is there a typical backstory of people in your care?
Well, typically, individuals that are sentenced to the CRC are sentenced on misdemeanor cases, meaning low-level cases, and they are serving a year or less.
This is a bit of an open-ended question, but I'm curious to see how you think about it. What would you say is the goal of incarceration?
The goal of incarceration is to change behavior, address needs, the needs of whatever has brought an individual into contact with the carceral system. Overall, just in general, approximately 97% of individuals in a carceral setting, jail, prison, will return to the community. So it's important that we provide programming and opportunity that supports change, because that is how we will, in fact, create safer communities once individuals are released.
So you mentioned programs and opportunities. Can you expand on what those are at the CRC?
Right. So we try to make sure all of our programming is evidence-based practice or aligned with evidence-based practices. A long time ago, when I started in corrections way back in 1996, you know, when I was trained, I basically did what my mentor told me to do. But shortly thereafter, there became a body of evidence to tell us what works in corrections, what types of things reduce recidivism. And so we try to make sure our programming is aligned with that. So that includes educational opportunities, job training, skills training, cognitive behavioral therapy, substance use disorder treatment, and those type of programs is what we have to offer at the Community Reintegration Center.
So you mentioned education, jobs, mental health, substance abuse help as things that work when it comes to rehabilitating or getting someone ready to reenter society. On the flip side, you mentioned you have a long career in corrections. What have you seen that doesn't work?
Sitting people in jail without offering them any type of programming. And the research, in fact, tells us incarceration without any treatment doesn't produce long-term change.
I can imagine that you run into people who see punishment and punishment alone as the goal of incarceration, that these people committed a crime, they need to be punished, and that's why they are in prison. Do you find yourself having to change minds and explain that your goals are a little more complicated than that?
Sure. I find myself having to educate people on what needs to happen while individuals are in custody. The fact of the matter, especially those individuals at the CRC, they're going to return to the community. So it's a matter of how do you want individuals to return to your community? I would assume better and not creating more victims. But then there are those who may have been a victim of a crime or experienced. A family member may have experienced some type of victimization and may feel like these people are in jail, so they don't deserve these opportunities. And for us, it's about, again, I'll say it over and over, it's about helping individuals produce long-term behavioral changes so that they don't get out and create more victims or continue being involved in criminal activity. And that is how we create safer communities.
So we aired an interview on Lake Effect that I did with Wisdom Wisconsin, and it was about their campaign to provide free video and phone calls to those incarcerated within Wisconsin. And the interview outlined how people incarcerated in Wisconsin foot the bill for staying connected to loved ones, often leaving them and their families in debt once they get out. Can you tell me about how you ensure that people in your care stay connected to loved ones while they're inside?
Sure. Under my tenure, we've done a number of things. One being that they do have free phone calls and free video visitation in Milwaukee County. We feel like it's important to keep people connected to their families. Under my leadership, we were also able to open up our visitation center. Hadn't been opened over a decade. Sheriff Clark shut it down. We've also hired a family outreach coordinator. His whole job, he is the liaison between the families and the residents in our care. So someone may call and say, I'm concerned about my son. I haven't heard from him in X amount of time. And that person will actually go do a wellness check or say, hey, call your mom. She's worried about you. And then another opportunity through a grant, we were able to open up a family visitation center. And so that was to serve our residents, the non-incarcerated parent, and the children, because the evidence tells us that family distress is a driver of recidivism. So we want to help to facilitate those broken familial bonds, because when someone becomes incarcerated, they're not the only people impacted. If they have a family, they're impacted as well. Then we have a Literacy Links program where parents are able to stay connected to their children through reading and promoting literacy, and they're able to go on a video visitation and read a book with their child or do homework help or send a recorded tape of them reading with the children. So we like I said, we try to stick pretty close to the evidence, and so we know that family distress is one of those top drivers of recidivism.
Do you find that families are typically eager to take part in this process?
We do not have to persuade family members to stay connected to their loved ones. As a matter of fact, I wasn't sure when we opened visitation that people would take advantage of it, simply because now we have the video visits and you don't have to drive all the way to Franklin, but our visiting stays full. So people are eager to stay connected to their loved ones. And our family outreach specialist in 1 year had thousands of contacts.
Yeah. So I want to talk about transparency. So have you allowed third parties, and this can be community groups, this can be other government agencies, to inspect conditions at the CRC on a regular basis?
Yes. So we've done a number of things where we've voluntarily let people come in and audit the work that we're doing. One was the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare. That is the gold star of healthcare in any correctional facility, and we've been accredited twice under my leadership. We also have Prison Rape Elimination Act, where we get an audit from the Department of Justice, a Department of Justice auditor every 3 years. And then we also have an annual jail inspection through the state of Wisconsin. And we have an audit coming up from the American Correctional Association this year as well. And that is the highest achievement that a correctional facility can obtain.
And are the reports that these auditors produce publicly available, or is that something only you and prison officials get to see?
Some are publicly available and some available through open records.
So when I've done interviews or reporting on jails and prisons in the past, staffing is often an issue that is brought up, particularly when the story revolves around substandard conditions at a jail or prison. Before getting into how you have addressed staffing at the CRC, can you explain generally the connection between fully staffing prisons and better conditions for those who are incarcerated?
Sure. Staffing shortages result in a lot of overworked employees. And so sometimes when individuals are overworked, they may tend to make mistakes. It's never ideal to have people working 16-hour days.
Now back to the CRC. When it comes to boosting staffing, what have you seen that works? Is it just offering higher pay and that's it? Or is it a little more complicated than that?
We have not quite figured out what works. We did boost the pay. And what that did for us was got us a greater pool of applicants. But once you get through the screening process, that doesn't necessarily translate into a lot of hires, although we have a lot of applicants. We are working on culture. Having been a correctional practitioner for 30-plus years, culture is very important, creating a culture of professionalism, a culture where people can grow and they can thrive in their careers. And so we're very fortunate at the CRC where there's a lot of opportunity for growth. You know, we have a number of supervisory positions that people can grow into. I just spoke to new recruits today before I came, encouraging them to treat the CRC or this opportunity as more than a job, but look at it as a career and create career pathways for individuals to grow in the industry.
Tell me more about culture, like how you think about culture at the CRC, both from the point of view of staff and from the point of view of people in your care.
So in terms of staff, I don't have an institutional background. I came from community corrections. And so when I got there, I noticed that my staff do a lot of things well in terms of security. But I wanted to help them to grow in other things. So we're bringing on things like crisis intervention, just equipping them with more tools to help them be more effective in their roles. And so that was something that I don't think staff were necessarily accustomed to, or elevating programming. So there's always been programming, but it's probably programming on steroids now. And so just communicating how we're going to move forward, that I don't see us as law enforcement. We are a corrections organization. And we've done things in support of that, such as changing language. We don't refer to anyone as an inmate or an offender. They are residents. They are part of the larger community. And so these are people that just have had some challenges. And so we're here to help them get back on track. But we are not the police. So we're not going to behave like the police. And so that was a bit of a shift in thinking for some of my staff. A lot have embraced the change, the name change, the House of Correction to the Community Reintegration Center. And for me, it's more than a name change. Our behavior has to align with who we say we are. The name change is aligned with our mission and vision. And so we want to make clear why we exist. You know, and so sometimes for tenured employees, change can be difficult. In terms of our residents, I think that they are getting more opportunities than they have historically gotten. We are intentional about staying connected to our community partner, so there is a smooth transition back into the community as we reintegrate people. We want people to be successful. We don't want to see that revolving door of people coming in and out. This job is not easy. A lot of people look at it and may think it's easy, but we are the gravity of the work. We are responsible for lives. Not only staff staying safe, but keeping our residents safe who come in with a number of challenges. When I say we, jails, prisons are the largest de facto mental health hospitals. So we are seeing people with that come in with significant mental health challenges that are higher risk than historically we've had to deal with. So that's a shift for us.
So a phrase you just used really stuck out, that jails and prisons are the largest de facto mental health hospitals in the state. Can you say more about that?
Sometimes when people misbehave or engage in certain behaviors, oftentimes due to their mental health conditions, sometimes there isn't anywhere to put them but jail. And so we end up with a population that we weren't necessarily equipped or trained to deal with. So we brought in additional training for our staff. Like I said, the crisis intervention training. We have a special dorm for individuals who have a hard time functioning in general population because of a mental health condition. And so they get a little more attention in our facility from the mental health practitioners. And we have specific programming to help them do better.
Chantel Jewell is the superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. She spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods earlier this year. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. A sociologist explores why poverty persists in a country as rich as the U.S. Next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Why does poverty persist in the U.S., the richest country in the world? Sociologist Matthew Desmond argues it's because everyone else benefits from it. Not just the wealthiest Americans, but those who are housed, college-educated, and secure. His book called Poverty by America explores why so many in the U.S. live in poverty and how to end it. Desmond attended graduate school at UW-Madison and won the Pulitzer Prize for his 2016 book called Evicted, which looks at housing and poverty in Milwaukee. The sociologist is also scheduled to speak at a UWM event moderated by WUWM's Catherine Kochel on April 30th. Desmond joins Lena Tran to talk about his latest book.
Many listeners will be familiar with your work from Evicted, you know, and so I guess reading this, it is really different. And I was wondering what the through line is here, how you got from that very zoomed in look at housing and poverty to casting this huge wide look at just about everything else.
I have been researching and reporting on poverty all of my adult life, basically. You know, I've lived in really poor communities. I've spoken to organizers and union reps and spent time with folks that are part of the working homeless and studied statistics and taught classes. And, you know, but I didn't feel like I really had a solid answer to a core question. Like if someone came up to me on the street and said, Matt, why is there so much poverty in America and how can we finally end it? What would it be my answer? And this book is my answer.
And you land on a pretty clear and damning answer, which is that the reason poverty is so persistent in our country is because those who are better off benefit from it. How do people who aren't living in poverty benefit?
We permit unrelenting exploitation of the poor in the labor market, in the housing market, in the financial market. So we allow workers to be really shortchanged, and we allow millions of folks to work for poverty wages. And who benefits from that? Corporations do, sure, but so do many of us that consume the cheap goods and services that the working poor produce. So do many of us who are invested in the stock market. You know, don't we benefit a bit when we see our savings go up, even if that requires a kind of a human sacrifice? We protect tax breaks that really are designed to subsidize affluence and not alleviate poverty. We protect things like the mortgage interest deduction or tax breaks for wealth transfers or retirement plans. And a lot of those tax breaks really accrue to the richest families in America, and that starves anti-poverty spending. And then many of us continue to embrace segregation. You know, we build walls around our communities through zoning laws, and we hoard opportunity behind those walls. We have to begin tearing down the walls. And I think we have to start taking steps as a country to finally abolish poverty.
Early on in the book, you tell this story of your friend Wu, who you met while you were living in Milwaukee. And he has this awful experience that is actually pretty common for people living in poverty. Could you share that story?
Sure. Wu and I lived together in a rooming house on the north side of Milwaukee. And he stepped on a nail there once, and he ignored the infection that started spreading. He just couldn't afford to pay it any mind. He worked all the time as a security guard. And pretty soon the infection accelerated, and it was accelerated by his diabetes, and he had his leg amputated. And traumatic, of course. You know, Wu was just a gregarious man. He's also a very big man, and I found him in the hospital. And just, he looked small, and we cried together. And then we applied for disability together for him, and he got rejected. And then he hired a lawyer, and the lawyer won the case. Wu got, I think, $3,400 in back pay, and the lawyer took home $400. Now, that never really bothered Wu. You know, he thought, you know, that's how he was able to get on disability. But, you know, I can't get over the fact that over $1 billion every year in Social Security funds doesn't go to people like Wu. It goes to lawyers to help people like Wu get on disability. And this is a big theme in America, where a lot of money that's earmarked for low-income folks never reaches them.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, it is this one story, but it's one of the many ways that, by and large, money set aside for anti-poverty programs doesn't really reach the people who need it.
Right. So that's another thing that really blew me away researching the book. We hear so much about welfare dependency. We heard so much about it in COVID. But if you look at the data, you quickly realize the problem isn't welfare dependency, it's welfare avoidance. There's so many families in America that are leaving a lot of aid on the table. And if you add up like the amount of aid that goes unused by 1 in 5 workers who could receive the earned income tax credit, which is like a wage subsidy for working parents, 1 in 5 workers don't claim it. 1 in 5 elderly Americans who could receive food stamps don't claim them. And you add that up with the folks that pass on unemployment insurance and government health insurance and, you know, things like that. You realize that every year, you know, over $140 billion, billion with a B, is left on the table. This is frankly the opposite of welfare dependence. And we might be like, what's going on? Is it stigma? Are people not reaching for programs that they need and deserve because they're embarrassed? And the answer seems to be not really, actually. There's some mixed evidence for that. There's more evidence for the fact that we've made these programs hard to apply for, onerous. We made it confusing, difficult. And so very simple steps like making the font bigger, helping elderly folks apply for food stamps, directly saying, hey, you know, you can apply for this. Did you know this? Sign up now. Really, really can work. And, you know, we live in a country where with a click of a button, we can have just about anything delivered to our door the next day, right? We know how to advertise. We know how to deliver things. Apply those skills and that know-how to helping families get connected to programs they need and deserve.
So you've just talked about ways that we could make it easier for people to access this money that is already earmarked for, you know, anti-poverty measures. Could you take some time to talk about your other solutions?
I think we need to do three things to end poverty in America. And I want to focus on the ending part. I do not want to reduce poverty. I want to abolish it. And a country as rich as ours certainly can afford to do so. The first thing we need to do is deepen our investments in anti-poverty spending. And it's not really hard to know where the money would come from. You know, a recently published study showed that if the top 1% of us just paid the taxes they owed, we could raise an additional $175 billion every year. That's almost enough to lift everyone out of poverty. We know how to do this. But we don't just need deeper investments, we need different ones. You know, we need to attack the unrelenting exploitation of poor folks. You know, consider the labor market. There was a time where if you got a job, you could advance in the company, you got some benefits, your wages went up every year. We are so far away from that today. And a reason is because workers have lost power. And so we need to find ways of empowering the poor, expanding their choice, especially with respect to where to live and how to bank. And then the third thing we need to do is finally end our embrace of segregation. We need to tear down the walls that we've created around our communities and really strive for inclusive communities based on broad prosperity. With those three steps, I think we could finally abolish poverty in this rich nation.
Throughout this book, you use the language of we and us, like you know the reader is going to be someone with a 401k, you know, but also you're with us. Can you talk about the discomfort of seeing yourself implicated in that system and maybe how to channel that into something productive, like becoming a quote unquote poverty abolitionist?
Yeah, you know, this is going to take all of us. And I really thought about that. Like, I'm so glad you brought this up. I really struggled with that language, the language of the book, because you're right. When you use this word, you're like, who is the we, right? Who's the book targeted toward? And at the very beginning of the book, I say the we is, you know, the lucky, you know, the college educated, the housed, the protected. And, you know, I grew up poor. You know, my family went through a foreclosure process before everyone else was doing it, you know. And I have, you know, a social mobility story like many Americans. And I think it's important for those of us that have found some security to ask ourselves how we are connected to the problem and thus connected to the solution. So I do think that means doing things like examining our consumer choices, looking at our investment portfolios, demanding more of our government. You know, I think that as a homeowner, I own a home now. You know, so I'm eligible for the mortgage interest deduction, for example. I don't want this deduction. I don't need it. Many folks that are taking this giant benefit from the government, a benefit that far, far outpaces direct housing assistance to the needy, we don't need that. And so I think the more of us that can speak out against this imbalanced tax system or welfare state that benefits many of us, the more that we can kind of rethink our consumer choices and our investment decisions, not only because those individual decisions are important, but also because it can really change the common sense and push the political will. And also, I think we have to invest in broad prosperity. And so that sounds abstract, right? Like, what does that mean? But often it means going down to your zoning board meeting on a Tuesday night and standing up and saying, look, I refuse to be a segregationist. You know, I refuse to deny other kids opportunity. My kids have had living in this neighborhood, build this thing. So I think that this isn't an argument that is designed to spur guilt. It's an argument designed to spur action and inspire us to reach for something better.
What makes you hopeful that we can make progress on what you're offering us, you know, that we won't stay siloed behind the walls that we have risen?
I'm hopeful because we have so many resources in this country, and we just have to push back against any suggestion otherwise. I think anytime we hear this idea like, man, how are we going to afford that? We just have to reject that dishonest, even sinful question. You know, we certainly have the resources to make major differences. Like, look at what happened in COVID, right? Like, we reduced child poverty almost in half in just 6 months. 6 months, you know? And so we have the resources, we have the know-how. That gives me hope.
Matthew Desmond is a sociology professor at Princeton University and the author of Poverty by America. He spoke with Lena Tran in 2023. Desmond is scheduled to speak at a UWM event moderated by WUWM's Catherine Kochel on April 30th. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the state of foster care in Milwaukee. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.